Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case, and Brad here. Potentially you guys
don't know a damn thing about it.
So thankfully, first and foremost, Brad and I are feeling much better compared to last week. If you guys listened to last week's episode, you know we were kind of knocking on death's door there for a little bit. Really miserable, really bad headaches, sinus infections, but we powered through it, and now we're feeling back to 100%, and so that's some good news. Now, you guys,
I'm not 100%, but I'm getting there.
I'm about 98%, so we're almost there. It's still an A. So as long as we're still an A, that's okay.
An A? Like we got an A?
Yeah, you get an A. Anything 90 and above was an A when I was in school, so. But also on top of that, you guys may notice that this episode is getting posted a little later. One part of that was because this whole past weekend, we spent it trying to rescue a cat from a tree. And I promise we'll get into the case here really soon, but I do have to mention the antics and shenanigans that went into trying to save this cat from at least like an 80-foot tree.
A stray cat, by the way, which is now, I guess, got a new home.
It is currently locked in the bathroom because it's cold outside right now and I don't want it to freeze to death. And I feel like we bonded because we tried everything. We tried to throw a tennis ball tied to a rope over the tree limb to try.
Had a clothes hamper tied to the other end as a cat carrying device.
And at one point, we even tried a drone with a rope tied to it to get the rope overneath the tree limb. So when I say we went all out to try and save this poor cat, we really meant it. But all that failed, and so I had to call an arborist to come climb the tree, go out onto a limb, and rescue the cat. And so here's just a little bit of info for you guys. If you do ever come across a cat stuck in a tree, and it's been up there for a few days, and it doesn't look like it's coming down, you can look up arborists in your area or tree services and contact them, and they'll usually actually send someone out to rescue the cat. The fire department will not do that. That is an age-old myth that I learned on the internet. So don't call the fire department, call a tree service, and they'll come out and do it for probably $100 because that's how much it cost me to get this stray cat.
I think you got a really good deal.
I also think I got a really good deal, but at the same time, you never know.
I mean, he climbed 80 feet up in a tree. It was actually pretty crazy.
And I'll actually post the video of it on our story on Instagram because it was really crazy watching him do it. But he got the cat. Cat's safe. And so that was our weekend. And so we're a little behind on recording. But, you know, it actually works out perfectly because today, Tuesday, when we're posting this, is actually a very special day in Beers with Queers history because it marks one full year that we have been doing this podcast. So it is so crazy to think that episode 1, The King Cobra Murder, came out 1 year ago exactly today. And so it's just crazy how much time has flown by because it really feels like it was just yesterday that we recorded the first episode. And we have not missed a single week since. So for a full year, we brought you guys at least one episode. So honestly, I feel a little pretty proud. You know, I think I've stuck longer with this than anything else, and I love it. I love doing it. I love researching the case. I love presenting it to you guys. And thank you guys so much to continue to support us and listen to the podcast. And we can't wait to see what another year brings. So with that, let's start getting into today's case. So for those of you who listen to the podcast regularly, you probably remember our episode covering Billy Greenwood and his bizarre murder mystery, where there was like 10 suspects who all had the means and the motive to kill him. And so we kind of framed that episode as a whodunit all the way up until the end. And this week's case is actually going to be pretty similar. So it's a case that shocked the small town where it occurred. And despite extensive searches and investigation, police and the community would be left baffled as to who could have possibly committed such a horrific crime. And when they finally discovered who was responsible, they were left speechless. So today we are covering the case of the Heinz Ice Cream murders and the ensuing investigation, and when I tell you that my jaw hit the floor the first time that I read the ending of this case, I'm not lying. It is one wild of a story. The ending is something like right out of a movie, so I'm interested to see your guys' reaction to it if you haven't heard this case already. Because even if you can guess who is responsible, you are never in a million years going to guess how they got away with it for almost 44 years. So, let's just jump right into it. It's the evening of Tuesday, April 11th, 1967 in Staunton, Virginia, and people were excited because it was the first true warm day of the season since spring had begun just about a week before. Now, one of the most popular places to visit as soon as things started to warm up was the Heinz Ice Cream Shop located in a shopping plaza called Terry Court towards the center of town. So the shop was the 1960s equivalent of what Ben & Jerry's is today, and it had multiple independent stores and chains popping up all over the state, and the most popular one in the area was this one, which happened to be owned and operated by the Heavener family. Now, the Heaveners were very well known in their small town and beloved by pretty much everyone you talked to. They were active in the community and were known for being kind and generous people. Now, of course, like most family-owned and operated shops, the family and all of their relatives made up the majority of the staff on any given day. April 11th was no different, with the two employees behind the counter being the family's 20-year-old daughter, Carolyn Heavener Perry, and Carolyn's sister-in-law, 19-year-old Constance Connie Smoots Heavener, who was married to Carolyn's older brother, Larry. Now, both girls were extremely popular with customers, and that made them very well known and beloved in the community, as people would just drive from all over just to say hi. So like I said, April 11th was the first warm day of spring, and the shop was filled with customers throughout the evening, and it was such a popular day, in fact, that the Heavener family decided that they'll extend their operation hours for the day to accommodate the influx of people, deciding to stay open till 10:45 p.m. instead of the normal 10 p.m. Now, of course, Carolyn and Connie weren't initially too thrilled with this idea, considering neither had actually been scheduled to work that day. In the first place, Carolyn was filling in for another girl who called out, and Connie was called in when the shop started getting too busy for one person. But, you know, they decided, whatever, at least they'd be making extra money, and so they continued to serve customers into the night. At about 10:30, the large crowd had died down, and only a few stragglers remained here and there as the two girls started preparing to close up shop for the night. Now, around this time, officers Robert Horn and Staunton Detective Dave Bocock, a 20-year veteran, just so happened to be patrolling the area by Heinz Ice Cream, and they even slowed down to peer inside as they drove by to make sure the girls were doing okay. Peering inside, they both see the girls are behind the counter, and one of them seems to be Connie counting the money from the register that day and putting it in an envelope, and Carolyn is leaning against the counter talking with another young girl. Now, Bocock isn't sure who the girl is since her back is to him, but he could tell the two knew each other and are just kind of having a casual conversation. He notices only one other customer inside the shop, an older gentleman who is sitting by himself in a booth enjoying a milkshake. Now, seeing that everything is okay, Bocock begins to drive out of the shopping plaza and passes a phone booth on his way out and notices a man standing inside staring back at him as he drives off. The detective goes about his usual patrol route for the next 30 minutes before he gets an urgent message across his radio. He needs to get back to the Heinz Ice Cream Shop immediately, because something terrible had just happened. So rushing back to the shop he was at just not even an hour before, Bocock rushed in to discover a horrific sight. Just about 10 minutes before, a local resident named Larry Robertson had decided to stop off at the shop in order to pick up a gallon of milk. The front door was unlocked and all the lights were still on, so he assumed they were still open, but when he went in, he found the entire place deserted and quiet. Now, he attempted to call out for anyone but received no answer, and that's when he started getting a feeling something was wrong as he stepped behind the counter and towards the back room of the shop where the office was. Inside, he discovered Carolyn and Connie both lying on the floor in a massive pool of blood and unresponsive. Larry immediately ran from the shop, and he used a nearby payphone to call for help. Now, arriving at the scene, Bocock found Larry sitting in his car sobbing, and he would later be taken to a nearby hospital in order to be treated for shock. So in the back room of the ice cream shop, Bocock found Carolyn Heavener lying face down on the ground and Connie laying face up across Carolyn's legs with her hand partially resting in an overturned bucket. So it was clear right away that both girls had suffered at least one gunshot wound to the head each. Checking for pulses, Bocock actually discovered to his surprise that both women were actually still alive, but barely clinging to life. Ambulances quickly rushed to the scene, but by the time they got there, Connie had sadly already passed away. Carolyn was still fighting and was loaded up and rushed to a nearby hospital, and as paramedics struggled to save Carolyn, Bocock and other investigators combed over the bloody scene to try and figure out what possibly could have happened in such a short time frame to lead to this. An envelope containing the receipts and money from the cash register that day was found still sitting on the counter, and although $138 was found to be missing from it, which today would be about $1,200, robbery seemed like a potential motive, of course, except for the fact that that was only about a fourth of the money from that day, so there were still thousands of dollars in the envelope that was left untouched. They then looked at the potential sexual motivation for the crime, and so it was later discovered during Connie's autopsy that she had either had sexual intercourse or was assaulted in the last 24 hours before her death. However, it was quickly confirmed that she and her husband had intercourse the night before, and on top of that, both girls were found still fully clothed, and it was confirmed that neither had been assaulted. So a sexual motive was also ruled out.
Plus, we're talking about like 30 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Do all of this in just 30 minutes.
Yeah, and so that's another thing they can't figure out, too, is the fact that all this happened in such a short time frame because he literally was looking inside the shop 30 minutes ago and nothing was fine. So that means someone had to come in, create some sort of hubbub, a struggle, and then murder two girls, steal some money, and then leave, all without being detected.
And plus, there was two customers. Well, a customer drinking his milkshake and then a guest in there talking to one of the people. So they would have had to have left, you know, within that 30 minutes too, so it could be even like a way shorter amount of time.
Oh yeah, and that's one of the things, like there's a bunch of moving parts here and people involved that it's a really hard time for police to figure out who's who. So meanwhile at the nearby hospital, Carolyn's husband Danny Perry was alerted to his wife's condition and rushed in to be with her. Carolyn was actually semi-conscious at this point, and upon seeing Danny, she actually began to try and get him to come closer to her, and according to him, acted like she wanted to try and tell him something important. Danny tried to get closer, but medical officials told him he needed to stay back as they were preparing to transfer Carolyn to a nearby hospital for better treatment. Danny tried to explain to them that she was trying to talk, but they assured him that in her fragile state, anything she said would probably not make much sense. So Carolyn was loaded back into an ambulance and was driven to the nearby Virginia State Hospital, but would sadly pass away from her injuries en route. Now, Danny would say for the rest of his life that had he been allowed to talk with Carolyn, she would have told him who was responsible for shooting her and Connie, and so he regrets that most to this day that he never actually got to speak with her. But now, with Connie and Carolyn now both dead, the investigation was going to be much harder to solve, as with both victims gone, and this was before the age of security cameras, so there was nothing like that. The only thing police had to go on was what they found at the scene. So before we move on, let's tell you a little bit about Carolyn and Connie Heavener. So Carolyn Heavener Perry was born on March 9, 1947, and she was the eldest daughter of eight children born to Virgil and Elizabeth Heavener. She graduated from Wilson Memorial High School in 1964 and got married to her high school sweetheart Daniel Perry straight after. The two would go on to have two children together with plans for more in the future. Now, sadly, Carolyn's father passed away in 1962, and following that, her mother got remarried, and soon the family went into business together and purchased the Heinz ice cream shop with Elizabeth acting as the general manager. So the venture proved to be extremely successful and was only continuing to grow at the time of the murders. And so they seemed to be on the up and up. The family was doing good. They were all in it together. Now, Connie Smoots Heavener was born on April 30th, 1947, to Virgil and Margaret Smoots, and was actually one part of the twins born to the couple with her twin brother named Carol. So Connie was described as being incredibly outgoing, was a cheerleader in high school, and was active in musical theater, and served as president of her school's photography club. So Connie met and married Larry Heavener soon after graduating high school in 1964, and following this, she went to work at the ice cream shop, where she got to know Larry's sister and her new sister-in-law, Carolyn, and the two quickly became best friends. So Connie and Larry had been trying to get pregnant since 1965, but each attempt failed, and since Larry was at work as a long-haul truck driver, it's kind of hard to coordinate it often. But one very tragic detail that would later come out is that Connie actually confided in several people earlier that day that she finally believed that she was pregnant and couldn't wait to tell Larry when he got back from work. So both women were said to be incredibly warm and friendly to everyone they met, and both were said by their families to be very deeply religious and took their Christian faith very seriously, often reading the Bible daily. Neither woman had any known enemies and weren't involved with any shady activity, so nobody could figure out who would want to kill them in such a brutal fashion to begin with. A later autopsy would reveal that both women were shot execution style, each with a single bullet to the head from a .25 caliber revolver. Carolyn seemed to have been shot first, following a brief struggle, as several items had been knocked to the floor, and she had slight bruising on her arms. Following this, police actually believe that Connie threw herself on top of Carolyn in an attempt to shield her from any more gunfire, and that's when the killer placed the gun to the back of her head and shot her as well. So with all this information that he has, which honestly isn't much at this point, Bocock is finishing up, going over the scene, and he still isn't sure what to make of any of it, and he already knows that it's going to be a long and difficult investigation. But that's when a surprise twist comes along that may offer a break in the case. So that night, as he's exiting the ice cream shop, of course a massive crowd of onlookers has already gathered around the taped-off scene, and Bocock is approached by a familiar-looking man. This man is actually the same man that he had seen standing in the phone booth earlier that night when he drove by. The man approached the detective and stated that he believes he may have information related to the case and reveals himself to be William Guy Thomas, a 24-year-old English teacher at a local high school who had just recently moved to the area with his wife, Sally. So Thomas explained to the detective that the phone lines in his new home had yet to be connected, and he had been coming over to use the phone booth in the Terry Court Plaza since it was located less than a block away from his new home. That evening, Thomas had gone to the phone booth in order to call his father, and it's during this time that he states he saw some strange activity coming from the High's ice cream shop. As he stood in the phone booth, he heard what sounded like someone dropping a hubcap really hard on the ground, and then saw two men, one white and one black, running out the front door of the shop. The white man was described as being the larger of the two in terms of weight and height and wore a blue sweater. The black man stood about 6 feet tall and was carrying something that looked like a pipe or some type of wrench. Now, after exiting the shop, the two men split up, with the white man running off through an open field toward a monastery, and the black man ran between two nearby houses. So, of course, this is amazing news. This is the first real break police have in the case, and it's an eyewitness, so police fanned out all over the city looking for these two suspects, and police began to scour the area where they were last seen running to look for any more clues. Now, by morning, the news of what had happened spread throughout the city, and pretty soon every news outlet was reporting on it all across the country, with the entire town of Staunton left terrified of a killer on the loose. And mainly it was just so terrifying because it just seemed so senseless and brutal and for no obvious reason. So there's just, they can't figure it out. It can't really be robbery because there was so much money left behind. Why they take such a minuscule amount if they're willing to kill two innocent girls over it? Didn't really seem to fit a sexual motive since neither girl was really harmed in that way. And so it really just seemed like a case of violence for violence's sake, which is even more scarier. So although police put out bulletins for people to be on the lookout for the two suspects described by Thomas, no helpful tips came in, and within a week the case had already started losing steam and was growing colder by the day, much to the frustration of Carolyn and Connie's families. Now of course, like any small town, rumors begin to spread about who and why someone may have murdered the two girls. Robbery was thrown around as being the most likely motive, since of course some, but not all, the money was taken from the shop. It also added credence to this theory because the store was actually broken into again just a month later, and another $200 was stolen out of a safety deposit box. But again, it just didn't seem right to not take all the money and go through all that trouble. Many people also suggested that maybe the murders were a crime of passion, and it may have been possible that either Carolyn or Connie was having an affair and attempted to break things off, resulting in their lover becoming homicidal. This was really suggested after a very strange clue was found inside of Connie's purse the night after the murders. In it was a note written by Connie that simply said, "Tell Larry that I love him." So this really seemed eerie to investigators and people alike, because it kind of seemed like Connie somehow knew something bad was going to happen to her. And so that started the rumor mill about, oh, maybe she had a secret lover and she knew things were getting bad. But of course, there's really absolutely no basis for any of these rumors. And the families of both girls completely denied these accusations and stated that both were extremely devoted to their husbands and their Christian faith, and they would never have an affair.
Yeah, it kind of sucks. I mean, they're victims already, and then everybody's like, yeah, you're also whores.
Yeah, that's the thing, too, is, like, they just have to add to it. Like, these poor families are already grieving. These poor girls lost their lives. And, of course, people got to talk. And so they're like, the worst thing, you're trashing their character after they can't defend themselves and with things that are not substantial at all. And so it's just one of those sucky parts when really noteworthy crimes like this happen, high-profile crimes like this happen. And it really sucks. And so the family really did their best to be like, don't tarnish. You may think you're trying to help the police solve the case, but don't tarnish the girl's reputation to try and do that. So by October of 1967, it had been months since the murders, and there had been absolutely no leads or new updates from police since the night of the murders, much to the anger and frustration of Carolyn and Connie's families, but specifically Connie's twin brother, Carol Smoots, who was enraged at the lack of progress to find his sister's killer. Connie and Carol were extremely close throughout their entire lives, and he was devastated when she died. He was upset with Carolyn's death too, as the two had actually dated in high school and ended things on good terms, so he was still a part of the family, he was still treated them nicely. And for months, Carol would regularly contact and question the lead investigators on his sister's case, Detective Bocock, asking for any sort of updates, because it seemed like they were literally doing nothing. He didn't know of any searches or interviews or questioning of anyone they had done, since the Hebner family told him that police never even questioned them about people in Carolyn's lives, or the people that knew her or her friends or other employees of the ice cream shop. None of them said they were ever contacted by police.
That seems really odd. It also seems odd, honestly, that they're not questioning that large family that all kind of have something to do with that business.
And so that's really weird. It didn't seem, well, they weren't publicly about it either, but it doesn't seem like they're doing anything to try and further this investigation. And I'd be pissed too. So it seemed like they were being lazy, and Carol did his best to keep them on their toes, asking all kinds of questions like, did you check the area for a murder weapon? Did you ask the other employees about any suspicious customers? Did you find out what the note Connie wrote meant? Things finally came to a head for Carol when he walked out to his car after work one day and discovered a parking ticket on his windshield. So Carol stormed down to the police station with the ticket and walked up to Detective Bocock, screaming in his face, "Is this what you and your people are worried about instead of finding out who killed my sister?" So Bocock started by ripping up the ticket before finally sitting Carol down and telling him that they are working tirelessly to find his sister's killer, but that it's an uphill battle since they don't have too much to actually work with. Bocock admitted, though, that they are still looking for two suspects running around from the shop that night with no luck, and that they had actually questioned and eliminated another suspect weeks prior.
Yeah, it seems weird in a small town that they wouldn't know the people that was in there.
That's a thing, too. It's a small town, and so someone in there, everyone knows each other. So you think it wouldn't take that long to figure out who was who in there?
Yeah, I mean, you also would think they would just ask and, like, put out a thing and say, hey, if you were these two people that were here that night, why don't you come in and talk to us? And, you know, of course, if they had nothing to do with it, they would come in and talk to you.
It's, yeah, so it seemed very simple, but apparently they weren't doing any of that. So going back to the suspect that they had found a few weeks earlier. So not long after the murder, a woman came to Detective Bocock named Joyce Bradshaw. Joyce was a nurse's aide at the local Western State Hospital, and she stated that on April 1st, 1967, 10 days before the murders, that she was approached by a coworker of hers, an 18-year-old woman named Diane Crawford, who asked if she would like to get something to eat with her at a new drive-in that just opened up. Now, Joyce accepted, although found it really odd since the two had never actually interacted before outside of work. But they went to the drive-in, and they were sitting in Diane's car eating burgers, and that's when Diane began to tell Joyce about her troubled home life before smiling at her and telling her to open the glove box. So Joyce did, and was greeted by the sight of a gun inside. Diane then went on to explain that the gun was her quote-unquote baby, and that she had recently purchased it from a shop called Montgomery Ward's in downtown Staunton. Now, Diane further explained that she had two bullets and that one was going to be for her stepfather, who she described as sexually abusing her throughout her childhood and even now as a teenager. She then stated the second bullet was for that quote-unquote, that Heavener girl. Now, Joyce was freaked out by this point and asked to be driven home, and she kind of just forgot about the whole thing until after the murders. Just one of those weird things, you know, that creepy coworker I think we've all had at some point in the past.
Yeah, you just forget about things like that, like a weird coworker that asks you out on a whim and then shows you a gun and tells you that she's got two bullets for two very specific people. Yeah, you just forget stuff like that. I could see.
Honestly, I would, because I worked at many retail jobs where there were, you know, coworkers like that, and I was just kind of like, sure, yeah, whatever. Also, this is the 1960s, so gunning people down like that just seems really odd. So again, this seemed like a really good lead, and so Diane was brought in for questioning. Now, she admitted owning a gun and getting burgers with Joyce, but denied having ever threatened anyone and agreed to take a polygraph, which she passed. Now, and of course, that doesn't have much credence even to this day, but again, it does mean something at least. She's able to pass a polygraph. Now, Detective Bocock was also able to confirm that the gun Diane owned did not match the bullets used to kill Connie or Carolyn. So, she was free to go, and they were back to square one. Now, Carol was satisfied for the time being that police were actively trying to find his sister's killer, and so he waited patiently for the next update. In the meantime, the families of the girls grew frustrated with the lack of updates in the investigation, and they decided to let the whole town know just how disappointed they were with the Staunton PD. So they took out an ad in the paper, which read in part, "On April 11th, 1967, our wives and daughters were murdered at High's Ice Cream Shop by persons unknown. To our knowledge, there has been no arrests or near arrest. This case is getting too old to be unsolved. The store has been robbed again, with police not knowing about it until someone had to call them the next morning. What are they waiting on? For someone else to be killed? It seems to us that there is very little being done. We hope the citizens of this city can get behind this case before it happens again, potentially to their loved ones." Now, little did they know that they wouldn't have to wait long before someone was finally arrested in the case. So just days after Carol met with Detective Bocock, investigators officially announced an arrest in the case. It was 24-year-old English teacher William Gus Thomas. So Detective Bocock was actually a little suspicious of Thomas, even from the very beginning. His story always struck him as someone who's trying to make up a lie to draw attention away from themselves, and so he always kept him as a suspect in the back of his mind. But of course, didn't really have anything to actually use as evidence against him, so he couldn't really do anything. That is, until word got back to Bocock that Thomas had been apparently going around town and bragging to people how he was the one who murdered the two girls in the ice cream shop and how he got away with it. And on top of that, a bloody quarter was found in the phone booth that Thomas was the last known person to use the night of the murder. So, he's brought back in for further questioning. And another really odd thing that struck investigators was just how eager and excited Thomas seemed to be to answer any and all their questions, to the point where he was actually brought in for at least four separate interviews and questionings, and each time he happily answered whatever they wanted and told him that. And each time he happily answered whatever they wanted and told them his theories and went off on long, nonsensical tangents. His versions of events of the night of the murders also started to grow more bizarre and contradicting with each interview. So Thomas was now saying that when he approached Detective Bocock that night, he was fully unaware that a murder had taken place and only assumed that something like a break-in must have happened since so many officers were there. After going home that night, Thomas tossed and turned in bed, knowing that something was wrong. He got up and went outside where he saw a mysterious boy with long blonde hair holding a newspaper and walking along his street. He approached the boy, and the boy confirmed that the two people had been found dead at the ice cream shop. Now horrified, Thomas got in his car and began driving around the area surrounding the ice cream shop, and as he passed a lonely alley, he spotted a large black dog carrying a pair of bloody blue jeans in its mouth. He got out of his car and tried to wrestle the bloody pants from the dog, but failed and the dog ran off. Thomas also finally admitted in his last interview that his story about seeing two dudes running from High's ice cream was a lie, and that he had made it up. He never actually saw anything.
Yeah, that's pretty bizarre. And he's admitting to lying, and the actual first story sounded sort of plausible, although the first thing that I thought was, I bet this guy's got something to do with it. But this new story with the dog and the kid with the long blonde hair and everything, this sounds a little weird. Also, it seems like you would, again, this is a small town. If there was a kid wandering around with long blonde hair, you'd think like everybody would be like, oh yeah, that's the Joiner kid or something down the road. You know, if you don't know that there's like that kid in a small town, they probably don't exist.
Yeah, and of course, that immediately made police suspicious, and it sent off a huge red flag for investigators. Now, I mean, he could be simply lying because he likes the attention. I've never been able to grasp my head around that, but all those people that make like those false claims or admit to false murders and kidnappings just because they want the attention. But it happens a lot. And he may have just loved the attention from being the star and only witness to this high-profile murder case. And so you can't quite disqualify that yet. Or he could be lying to try and throw police off his trail if he's somehow involved. Now, things only seemed more suspicious for Thomas when police dug further into his background and they discovered some pretty questionable things. Talking with his wife, they discovered that he had a violent temper, and on at least one occasion, he threw his wife to the ground and attempted to choke her. Investigators also learned that he had recently been fired from his last teaching job after less than a year for punching a student in the face. Now, things seemed to only get even worse for Thomas when two men actually came forward and claimed that they had overheard him confess to the murders the day after the crime. So, a pretty strong case seems to be forming against them, but at the same time, investigators weren't sure what to make of all of it, because it was also very obvious that Thomas was very mentally ill.
I was just about to say, he sounds mentally ill to me.
And in fact was, at the time, an undiagnosed schizophrenic, who often had trouble remembering things correctly, and even often hallucinated that he was somewhere else entirely during certain situations. So sometimes he'd be like, yeah, I vividly remember I was outside playing baseball with the neighbor, and then the entire time he was actually just sitting on his couch. So he had very vivid hallucinations and sometimes wasn't even anywhere near he remembers him being near. He also was a very compulsive liar and often came up with fantastical stories to try and appear cool. So it's unclear how much of anything that actually came out of his mouth was actually true, how much of it was a lie, and how much of it he genuinely believes happened. So it was kind of one of those things, it starts to look a little less suspicious, but still really weird. Now, the bloody coin found in the phone booth after Thomas used it also failed to turn up anything meaningful, and so even with most of the evidence against him, widely circumstantial, and Detective Bocock feeling that it wasn't enough to make a slam dunk case against anything, the rest of the police force were feeling extremely pressured to arrest someone in the case, and they urged Bocock to go through with it and take his chances. And so in October of 1967, He did and officially arrested Thomas for the murder of Carolyn Perry Heavener.
I was just about to say, well, at least the cop isn't going to take like the easy way out and just pin it on this guy because he's mentally ill and everything like that. Because, of course, you see so many stories from back in that time where it's like, oh, you happened to cross the street at the time of murder? Okay, you're guilty. So I was like, at least this guy's on the up and up and he's not going to just take this poor mentally ill guy in and lock him away because he's easy prey. But I was wrong.
So that's something, too. You know, a lot of people like to mention, when you look at, like, statistics and stuff, they'll be like, it's weird that we were solving more murder cases in the 60s than we are today, which is true. If you looked at the statistics, like, it's really disproportionate. Like, a lot more cases were getting solved in the 60s than today. But that is because back then, it really didn't matter if you did it or not. If you were a good scapegoat for the crime, more often than not, police would be like, he'll do, pin it on him, throw him in jail. That's the end of it. So it has less to do with the actual criminal getting convicted and more to do. Oftentimes, police were just kind of like, eh, good enough, move on to the next one. And so this is another case of that where even like they're like, this is not a good case at all. There's no real evidence, no murder weapon. It's all just hearsay from people who aren't even sure that he was even anywhere near the ice cream shop. And so, but at the same time, they're like, we'll take our chances because they want someone to blame for this crime. But also, he only charged him with the murder of Carolyn because Pocock also knew that it wasn't a good case, so it is more than likely he might potentially be found not guilty. And so it's better to charge him with just one of the murders, because if you try someone and they found not guilty, it doesn't matter if you find everything that you could possibly want. You can't try them again. Double jeopardy. But if he only charged him with Carolyn's murder, then he could still charge him in the future for Connie's murder if more evidence came to light. So he decided that was the best course of action and charged Thomas with just one of the murders. Now, Thomas was arrested but maintained his innocence in the crime and was eventually actually released on bond while awaiting trial, which was set to begin in April 1968. Now, of course, his arrest was already made public and everyone knew he was charged with the Hayes murders, including Connie's twin brother, Carol, and he was furious at the thought of his sister's killer walking free. Carol began lying awake at night, thinking of how brutally his sister and Carolyn were gunned down, and inside the shop and how their killer was still walking free. He stewed on it for several days, despite people trying to tell him that it was a largely circumstantial case and that there was a good chance it wasn't Thomas. Detective Bocock actually came to Carol's house not long after Thomas was released on bond, and he warned him that if something bad should befall Thomas before his trial date, whether it be an accident, or he gets sick, or dies randomly, Bocock knew Carol was behind it and he would have him arrested. So Carol kept his distance from Thomas for several weeks, until one incident when he saw Thomas walking out of a store in town as he drove past, and the rage filled him up again. He parked his car, armed himself with a gun, and actually started to approach Thomas, fully intent on getting his revenge. But as he got closer and was getting ready to shoot, a voice in his head told him, "What if it's not him?" And that was enough to keep him from doing anything drastic, and he decided to trust in the law and that they would do the right thing. So Thomas went on trial for the murder of Carolyn in April 1968, and the case was very noticeably weak to everyone because there was no actual physical evidence tying him to the murders, and the case relied solely on several quote-unquote eyewitnesses who stated that they saw a man who kind of looked like Thomas eating an ice cream in the shop not long before the murders took place. Two men claimed to have seen Thomas enter the shop not long after 10 p.m. and approach the counter, and a woman claims to have seen a man with similar hair to him sitting alone at a booth near the counter. Now, none of these witnesses could actually confirm that it was Thomas they saw, and their stories just fell apart under cross-examination. Prosecutors also decided to go with the robbery motive being Thomas's motive, since there was some money taken from the day's profit. But again, this didn't really make sense because Thomas's wife and parents both testified that he had plenty of money in the bank, almost $50,000 worth, and so it did not make sense for him to kill two girls for less than $200. Thomas's wife, Sally, also testified that he had actually asked if she wanted to go with him to the phone booth that night, but she declined, and that he came home just 20 minutes later. The trial lasted less than a week, and finally the jury left to make their decision, and in just 3 hours returned with a verdict. On April 11, 1968, a year to the date of the murders, Thomas was found not guilty of the murder of Carolyn. Now, investigators assured the public that they would proceed with a second trial for the murder of Connie once they gathered enough evidence against Thomas. But by this point, the public was less than enthusiastic, as it just seemed to everyone that police got the wrong guy.
I mean, it seems kind of obvious they're just trying to pin it onto somebody so that the public will leave them alone at this point.
And the public's kind of gotten sly to that idea, like, we know you're just trying to do this to get us to shut up about it, but we don't think it was Thomas. So Thomas's trial seemed to be the final nail in the coffin for the Heise Ice Cream murders, as the case officially went cold and no new evidence or leads would be found by police. The town moved on slowly, and the more years that passed, the more the murders seemed to slip out of their memories until it became more of an urban legend than a real case. The family sold the shop just a couple of years later, and it sat abandoned, and it just is one of those things where it kind of just slowly starts to fade from the public memory. But now the families of Carolyn and Connie continued to grieve their loved ones, as it seemed justice would never be served. For 44 years, the case of the Heise Ice Cream Shop murders would go unsolved, with Thomas being the first and only arrest in the case. But one man's 44-year hunt for the truth was about to pay off in a very unexpected way. So Roy Hartless was just 14 years old when Carolyn and Connie were murdered. He worked as a paperboy and was very familiar with both women, who often chatted with them when he delivered their papers. Now, Roy was heartbroken to hear their passing and devastated that their killer had never been caught. The case stuck with him all throughout his teenage years, and it was a major factor that caused him to join the Staunton Police Force after graduating high school in 1973. So for 15 years, Roy worked as an officer before getting transferred to the department's Criminal Investigation Unit, where he began working on all the cold cases in the town. Now, the unsolved case of the Heise murder became his prime focus, as he began to go about re-interviewing old witnesses and going over any evidence that may have been missed before, but found nothing new or conclusive. Now, he worked closely with Detective Bocock for many years on the force and often sought his advice on what he really thought happened that night. Bocock admitted that he had long given up on solving the case and that in the end, he thinks it was a simple robbery gone wrong. Bocock eventually retired from the force in the early 90s, and Roy continued to keep the case in the back of his mind while working other cases. Now, by 2008, any hope of solving the case had long since disappeared. Even with the advancement in technology, there was little they could do since they had no DNA and they didn't even have the murder weapon. But little did the city of Staunton, the families of Carolyn and Connie, and Roy Hartless know, the truth of everything that had happened that night was soon to be revealed in the form of a deathbed confession. The deathbed confession
of Carol?
The deathbed confession of somebody no one had ever come to suspect. The deathbed confession of a 60-year-old woman named Sharon Diane Crawford Smith.
For some reason, I was suspecting Carol because he was just too over the top with everything.
He was a brother grieving, though. He really loved his sister. So let's go back a little in August of 2008. A relative of Connie's family named Lyle Sheets was a well-known and beloved business owner and someone who had never given up hope in catching Connie and Carolyn's killer. He continued to ask for tips and offer rewards for any information well into the 2000s. One day during a yard sale held by his daughter, he was approached by a woman named Joyce Bradshaw. Joyce knew of Lyle's continued efforts to find the killer, and she confided in him the story she had told police some 40 years earlier, the one about going to dinner with Diane showing her gun and telling her one of the bullets was for the Heavener girl. Now, Lyle had never heard this before and quickly phoned Roy, who has also never heard of Diane before, and was curious as to why. Now, he soon discovered through the Heavener family records that Diane actually worked at Haas Ice Cream with Carolyn and Connie as a part-time employee. He set out to track her down and found that it wasn't that hard as she was right there in Staunton in an assisted care facility. So Roy set out to interview her and found her in her hospital room, dying of kidney and heart failure. Roy asked if Diane would speak to him about her life in 1967, and she agreed. Going through the interview, he kept things casual for a moment, and Diane actually admitted that she was the employee that Carolyn was covering for the night of the murders. Diane had actually called in sick that day. Now, after keeping the questions brief and casual, Roy finally got serious and asked Diane straight up, "What would you say if we told you we believe you had something to do with the murders?" Suddenly, all the color drained from Diane's face as she seemed to get nervous and tense up. She got really angry and irritated at this notion and refused to answer any more of their questions, ordering them to leave. As he left, Roy would later say that he knew right then and there that Diane was responsible. He just wanted to know why. Now, as it turns out, he wouldn't have to wait long because just days later, he received a call from Diane who stated she was finally ready to admit to everything. Roy rushed back to the hospital and found Diane in serious condition, but willing and able to talk with him. She started by saying, "I shot them." When asked why, she stated, "I lived a very different lifestyle back then, and those girls just would not stop taunting me for being a lesbian." Diane went on to explain that on the night of the murders, she had gone to Haas in order to tell the girls that she would be unable to work the following night. She had just gotten a job at the nearby Weston Hospital as a nurse's aide and was going to pick up a shift there. Now, this apparently did not go over well with Carolyn, and the two eventually got into a screaming match, which turned into a pushing match, which turned into Diane pulling out her gun and shooting Carolyn through the head. From the front of the store, Connie rushed in to see what was going on and saw Carolyn lying on the floor in a pool of blood. She yelled, "You bitch," at Diane before throwing herself on Carolyn to stop Diane from firing anymore. Diane then shot Connie through the head too before running back out front, taking $138 from the deposit slip in a kind of half-hearted attempt to make it look like a robbery gone wrong. Diane would later claim that she had never intended to actually kill the girls, and she only wanted to scare them because she had grown to hate them for their constant teasing and picking at her for being a lesbian. When asked how the girls knew she was a lesbian, Diane simply replied, "How do kids always know anything? They just know. I wore my hair short. I never had a boyfriend. I was different. I was just pushed so far, so I shot them." The teasing had gone on for a while. Now, of course, we have to remember this is 1960s Virginia. Stonewall was still 2 years away, and by this point, homosexuality was still listed and treated as a mental illness, with electroshock being the most popular treatment for it, or even a lobotomy at times. In fact, just a month before the murders, CBS Report actually aired the very first nationally syndicated broadcast special about homosexuality entitled "The Homosexuals." Now, the hour-long program examined several openly gay men and went to great lengths to paint queer people as being severely unhappy and mentally unwell, and has gone on to be called the single most destructive hour of television in its portrayal of queer people. The program also revealed that at the time, 2 out of every 3 Americans interviewed thought of homosexuality as being disgusting. Now, Connie's mother would be interviewed in 2009 and asked about her daughter's view on homosexuality. She stated that Connie would have never mocked someone or bullied someone, and instead, if anything, would have pulled Diane aside and tried to get her to, quote-unquote, live her life right. But now, of course, Carolyn and Connie were also teenagers, and we all know teenagers are 2 completely different people around their friends and their family. So it does seem pretty likely that there was a good chance the girls did make fun of Diane and made snide comments about her for being a lesbian. But even if the comments were ignorant, that does not give Diane the right to murder them in cold blood. And so it was taken very far. Now, by the time Diane was finishing up her interview, it was clear that her health was fading fast, as she would often become delirious and forget where she was when speaking with Roy and several people from the Staunton PD he brought with him. By the end of it, they were satisfied that Diane was telling the truth and she was their killer. They asked her about Guy Thomas and if she was aware that for 40 years now, everyone had believed he was the one responsible. Diane admitted that she was aware and read all about his trial often, but she didn't feel compelled to come forward. She also admitted that she continued to work at Highs for several weeks after the murders and even met her future husband while working a shift there. She attended both Carolyn and Connie's funerals, and it was during Connie's funeral that she looked at her in her casket and noticed the hole in her neck where the bullet exited, and it was still visible, which deeply upset her. To the point she actually checked herself into a mental hospital for several months. Now, following this, she moved away and got married to a man, and they would go on to have two kids together before divorcing in 1986. Diane would move back to Staunton, where she would meet a woman named Sharon and move in with her. The two became life partners and were in a committed relationship for several years by 2008. So now investigators had a pretty good idea of Diane's whole life after the murders, but there was still a very important unanswered question. Mainly, where was the murder weapon? Now, I mean, her confession made plenty of sense and it lined up with everything at the scene, but it's still all just hearsay from a terminally ill woman on her deathbed. But now if they had the gun, the case would be a slam dunk, and they were hoping Diane still had it. But when they asked her about the gun, they were not prepared for her answer at all, and everyone was left speechless by what she would say happened to it. Diane told them that she didn't have the gun anymore because she had given it to someone. When asked who she gave it to, she simply stated, "I gave it to Detective Bocock the night after the murders." So now, of course, Roy and the officers, and I'm sure you guys at home were like, wait, what? So Diane went on to explain that after she murdered Carolyn and Connie, she just drove around aimlessly for several hours trying to figure out what to do. She finally settled on going out to Davy Bocock's farm and waiting for him to arrive home. After he arrived, she confessed everything to him and handed him the gun. He told her he'd take care of it and proceeded to bury the gun in a small box on his property before Diane claims he dug it back up years later and gave it to a deputy on the force that remains unknown to this day, and the gun has since been lost.
That's a big accusation right there.
It is a very big accusation, and that's what they're thinking too. Diane also went on to say that following Joyce Bradshaw coming forward and confessing what Diane had told her the week before the murders, so this was actually coming from Joyce Bradshaw. Joyce said that she never came forward again with the story because the first time she did, she told Bocock, and then Bocock told her that Diane had passed the polygraph and that her gun wasn't a match for the bullets found at the scene. Except it was a match. It was a .25 caliber gun just like the bullets found at the scene. So by this point, everyone is super confused about what is going on. And of course, they don't really believe anything that Diane is saying about a detective helping her cover up a murder. But also, she has been completely honest and open about everything else. So they decided to do some digging, and what they found was horrifying. Going back through Bocock's old files on the investigation, police found that there was next to no actual investigation at all. Bocock never interviewed anyone in Carolyn and Connie's families. He didn't log or bag evidence from the scene. His only notes on what happened the night of the murders is describing how he drove around, and he just filled the report with very unnecessary and unrelated details. What was normally a 20 to 30 page report of details was a measly 2 pages. One investigator would later tell the press, "We would have more information on a petty larceny case than the Highs ice cream murder case. I don't know what he was doing or didn't do, but it doesn't appear that he did a whole lot." Now, it starts to get weird when they dig even further and discover that Bocock and Diane were extremely close throughout Diane's teenage years, with her often spending her free time going to his farm and practicing her shooting and aim. This farm was actually given to Diane when she was older, and that's where she lived with her new partner. So a chill starts to set in with Roy and everyone else in the room as they realize Diane is telling the truth. The man who was the lead investigator on the case, the man who attempted to frame an innocent man for the crime,
was her father.
The man who worked side by side with Roy Heartless for over 15 years was the one responsible for helping cover it up. But there was never going to be any way to get Bocock's side of the story of this, because that was impossible. Because Detective Davy Bocock died in 2006, 2 years before Diane confessed to everything. Now, Diane refused to answer any questions in regards to what their relationship was, and it's at this point she told the investigators to get out of her room, and so they did, still with more questions than answers. So, you said, what's her father? We will go over theories about what their relationship was, and we'll kind of let you guys decide, because nothing has been proven. So following this interview with Diane, Roy was sure that an arrest would soon follow, but he would be disappointed when over 2 months passed without any new updates on the case. So by this point in his life, Roy was actually retired from the police force, and he now worked as a private investigator, so he had no had real legal jurisdiction anywhere. And so he was really relying on the actual Staunton PD to use the info he gathered to make an arrest. Now, when Roy would try to question anyone on the force about what was taking so long, he was met with silence or an excuse by the chief of police. Roy believes that the Staunton PD was intentionally trying to prolong an arrest, hoping that Diane would just die soon so they could sweep the whole thing under the rug. The story of a seasoned detective covering up the murder of two teenage girls doesn't really look good on them. Now, Roy finally took the info he had to the media, and with renewed interest in the case, he forced them to act. So, on December 10th, 2008, Diane Crawford was officially arrested for the murder of Carolyn and Connie. Now, after her arrest, Joyce actually came forward again and told investigators that Bocock was the reason she never told anyone else about the story. She claims that after initially telling Bocock the story, he called her back a few days later and told her that Diane had passed the polygraph, although the file would later show that Diane never actually took a polygraph. He also told her that he was good friends with Diane and that she was, quote-unquote, one hell of a shot. Now, Joyce immediately took this as a threat to keep quiet, and even more so when right after this talk with Bocock, she received a call from Diane, who told her to keep her mouth shut if she knew what was good for her. So Joyce was, of course, terrified to come forward until Bocock was dead. So even after her arrest, Diane was too ill to be held in prison and was returned to the assisted living facility where she was staying, and any hope for justice died when on January 19th, 2009, Diane passed away from kidney and heart failure, taking her secret relationship with Detective Bocock to the grave. Now, even after her death, the investigation continued as police were still trying to figure out what compelled Detective Bocock, a 20-plus year respected veteran of the force, to go to such lengths to cover up a crime for a girl that no one even knew he knew or was that close with. So many theories have been put forth over the years about how the two found each other. Some think that the two were having a secret love affair. Some think that Bocock was the father of Diane's first child that she gave away. This is thought by some because of an odd detail in Diane's obituary that reads that she had an unnamed daughter that lives out of state and that she would have had it around the time of the murders. But yet no one in her life can recall what happened to it, and many who didn't even know she was pregnant, and so there is a child that's unaccounted for that no one even knows the name of. But now others think it may even be more personal than that. See, Bocock was known as a real ladies' man throughout his entire life, ever since he was a teenager. Diane's birth certificate lists no one as the father when she was born on August 24th, 1948, to an unwed mother. Her mother was only 16 when she had her, and she lived in a house just down the street from the Bocock family farm, where Bocock was 18 years old at the time. Now, these odd clues have led many to believe that it is more than possible that Bocock could have actually been Diane's father. Diane's mother is actually still alive, and to this day, she refuses to answer the question, who was Diane's father? Any hope for a possible DNA match to prove or disprove it was also out of the question, as Bocock had himself cremated after death. His surviving children and family members have also all refused to give samples for testing, and until one of them changes their mind, the secret relationship between a man of the law and a murderer will forever remain a mystery. And to close it off, Guy Thomas actually sued the Staunton PD after all this came out because he became a pariah in the town of Staunton. He was forced to move. Even after his acquittal, he was forced to move. He couldn't get a job because he was known as the prime suspect in a high-profile murder case. And so 40 years, his life was ruined because of this. And he sued them for like $40 million, but the case was thrown out, so he didn't really get any justice. And to this day, we are left wondering, what kind of relationship did these two have, Diane and Detective Bocock, to make him literally become an accessory to murder? And it is one of those fascinating things. It kind of reads like a Lifetime movie. Was this his long-lost daughter? Was it his lover? Did him and her have a secret child that she got rid of? You really don't know. And until something changes, it's just one of those things that you get to kind of think about and brew on forever.
Well, that was an interesting one.
It was an interesting one. One of those fascinating ones, like, you never read a case of the lead detective on the case. And that's the other thing, too, is, like, he did not know Diane was involved when he originally was investigating that night. When he got to the scene, he was called there. It was just pure fate. And it was not until the next night that he realized that she was the one that did it. And it's at that point he was like, okay, then I'm going to cover it up for you. And it's just so fascinating how all these pieces fell in together to make this case so horrifically tragic and unsolved for 40 years, even though the lead detective on the case knew exactly who did it and had the murder weapon since the night after the murder. It's just wild to think about. And with that, thank you guys again so much for tuning in for another week. Thank you guys for celebrating 1 year of Beers with Queers with us. Couldn't do it without you. We do it because of you. And thank you guys so much for tuning in each week. If you really enjoyed the podcast and you haven't already, you can leave us a 5-star review or rating on iTunes or Spotify. Helps us out a lot, helps other people discover the podcast. And we just love hearing your guys' feedback. If you want to see photos from this case, you can follow us on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers, a true crime podcast. And until Monday, stay dangerous out there, my friend.
See you Monday.
Bye.